Well, one more time. Welcome, welcome. Once more into the breach, right? This is episode seven of the Second Coming series. And I'm Dr. Kelly Nelson Burks. I'm the pastor of Messiah Reformed Church in Omaha, Nebraska. And we're glad to have you with us wherever you are watching and listening to this teaching. We've been carrying on this series for, well, this will be episode seven, obviously, so we're in our seventh week, and so far so good. Lots of people watching the videos and hearing from some people here and there. Please do feel free to contact me as you would with comments, questions, anything along those lines. DrKellyNelsonBurks.com. There's our website address. And if you want to tweet me, then it's at Dr. Kelly Burks, at Dr. Kelly Burks. And Brian, I'm sure, has got it down there so you can see all of this. And we really want to give thanks to Brian for all the production work that he's been doing. Who's this Brian guy? Well, that's Elder Brian Dogan. There, his name is out there. He's one of these weird guys too. Anyway, he's doing a lot of work. He's the one who's putting all of the work and the time and the energy into a lot of this. Also, Brother Frank Sikora, another member of our church, he does a lot of the shooting of this, and we're appreciative of the men in this church that chip in and use their gifts and their time and their energy to bring this teaching of the Word to you, as well as the folks that that are trepidatious and they come every Tuesday night to sit through this little audience that is here in the sanctuary at Messiah Reformed Church. And we're kind of toughing it out tonight because our heater is not working at the moment here at the church, and so it's a little bit cool. You should see some of these folks in their parkas. And Jen's over here. She's got her wintertime, you know, cap on that's going on right now. She has gloves on, and she's got a pen in one hand, and she's ready to take notes. She's going to write with these winter gloves on, so that's pretty tough right there. All right, so enough of that. Let's jump right back into where we left off. We are in now part two, episode seven, part two of The Heavens and the Earth. The Heavens and the Earth. Now, why are we dealing with this? This is a part of what is necessary to understand relative to preterism, which, of course, as by this time you know, means that which is past, in the past, comes from the Latin pretor, past in history. And that's what we're referring to when we refer to this eschatological understanding of what the Bible means by what it says in regards to the arena of prophecy, how that all prophecy relative to the second coming of Christ, relative to the resurrection and the judgments, had its fulfillment within the first century. That's right, you heard me right. The first century from AD 66 to AD 70, there in Jerusalem, with the attack upon Jerusalem as the Lord Jesus prophesied that it would be by the armies of Rome and the 10 army confederacy of the various empires that were under, the various nations, I should say, that were under control of Rome then, and fulfilled and historically rectified and recorded for us by men like the Roman historian Tacitus, by the Jewish historian Josephus, and men like that, as well as other works here and there that have been written since the beginning of that period and then throughout the last 2,000 years. A lot of people are not aware of this because of dispensationalism. Dispensationalism coming in just after the beginning of the early 1900s, brought over here from Scotland by John Darby and popularized by C.I. Schofield in the Schofield Reference Bible, and so much has taken on a life of itself, and so there's very little understanding out there about this historical biblical position known as preterism. Now, there's different kinds of preterists out there today. You've got idealist preterists, you've got partial preterists. I just refer to myself as a preterist. I just believe that these things are in the past because the Lord Jesus said they would be in the past. And of course, if you've been a good student and you've been listening to all of these episodes from the first one all the way up to this point, you've already had a ton of biblical teaching in regards to Christ's teaching on the timing and the meaning of what it meant for him to come back in his second coming, or as the New Testament uses the word, his parousia, his presence. You've had all of that already, as well as some other things. So this area of the heavens and the earth now, we started the first part, obviously, last week in episode 6. And if you have not gone through episode 6 and you're right here on episode 7, that's no good. You need to stop. You need to go listen to episode and watch episode 7 that deals with part 1 of the heavens and the earth. Now, we opened up last week talking to you out of 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter, in regards to this concept of the heavens and the earth. I'm not going over there right now. We did a little bit of a cursory overview of that last week, and if we have time, I'll do a little bit more detail in it tonight at the end, towards the end of our teaching. But we opened up with 2 Peter 3. We talked verses 1 and 2, where the scoffers were scoffing at the apostolic teaching of the first century, saying, where is the promise of his coming? Coming is the Greek word parousia, and arrival with a consequential presence. And these people were scoffing at this because, now why were they scoffing at it? Because that's what the apostles and what the first century church were teaching, that Christ would be back in that first century generation before the destruction, and at least at the destruction of the temple. Because in the Olivet Discourse, the Lord Jesus taught that that was going to be the earthly sign of his second coming, his parousia, the destruction of the temple. And we're trying to get through a lot of this foundational material so we can actually take you through a verse-by-verse teaching of Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse. But Peter starts off that way in the third chapter of 2 Peter, and then he moves into the fact that he begins to defend the fact that this is what they have taught, this is what has always been taught in the first century, and he begins to speak about how that the heavens are going to be on fire, the earth is going to melt, and the elements in verse 10 and verse 12 of the third chapter of 2 Peter, that those things were going to melt. And using the phrase heavens and earth and the idea of the word elements, which I'll come back to, which I talked about last week. And it's important for us to understand, what is Peter referring to when he uses this phrase, heavens and the earth? What has normally been taught, especially since about the middle of the second century and forward, is there has been a literalistic cosmology relative to the definition of the term heavens and earth. When these things are said to be melting, they're said to be on fire, it's been taken as the earth is going to blow up, that God is going to bring some kind of a literal fire upon the planet, and then he is going to reform, rebuild the planet, as it were. And we spoke to you last week a lot about Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 4, as well as Psalm 104, passages out of Psalm 119 and other passages that speak about the fact that this earth is going to abide forever. And so it's not going anywhere. So we opened up last week talking a lot about that. And then I took you into some Old Testament passages, took you all the way back to Genesis, the first chapter, and then Genesis, the second chapter, verse 1, verse 2, where he talks about the fact that the heavens and the earth, Genesis 2, 1, were completed in that day, and all of their hosts. So we've got in the first chapter of Genesis, we've got this six-day scenario where the physical planet is being completed. And yes, the heavens and the earth in contexts, certain contexts, are, but not all the time, but are in some contexts referring to the physicality of the brute creation, the inanimate objects of creation, the earth, the sky, the rocks, the dirt, the plants, and that kind of a thing. But that there are many other passages that use the phrase heaven and earth to talk about things like the foundation of one's religion, a culture group's religion, or their economics, or their philosophy. It could be the foundation and the ABCs of a kingdom. We pointed out to you in certain passages where the term heavens and earth, especially as Moses uses the term, and we're going to get back into him tonight, where he talks about the heavens and the earth as being that which is to be understood as God's covenant with his people. Could be the Abrahamic covenant, could be in reference to the Mosaic covenant, aspects of the law. And we even read to you last week out of secondary sources like the historian Josephus, who uses the phrase heavens and earth to actually talk about how that the temple in first century Judaism was referred to as the Jews' heavens and earth. And we talked to you about the fact that just like we have slang in our society that we don't mean to take literally, but immediately it's understood what we're talking about. So the Jews had a type of a slang, and it was carried over from the Old Testament prophets into the first century, Jesus and the apostles when they did their teaching and then wrote the Gospels and then some of the epistles therein. Use this terminology, oftentimes speaking to Jews who would understand it themselves, and we have taken it, and through this loss of Jewish hermeneutical understanding, that's method of interpretation, because there's been such a loss of that from the second century onward with the coming of what historians refer to as the postponement theory. Kurt Aland, in his History of Christianity, refers to this as the postponement theory, that with that, because there has been a loss of Jewish understanding within the church from the second century forward, there has come this literalistic cosmology that has crept into the church from a Greco-Roman pedagogical system, a school of instruction system, which treats everything as literal. So when you talk about the sun, moon, and the stars, you talk about the heavens and the earth, these phrases, which are packed with meaning within the Old Testament Jewish understanding of the scriptures, it gets changed from their original meaning into, well, the literal sun, moons, and stars are going to go black, the moon's going to turn to blood, the star's going to fall, you're going to have all these stars and comets falling on the earth, onto the ground, and then the heavens and the earth, well, they're going to melt, there's going to be this intense heat, like 2 Peter 3 says, they're all going to burn up. Well, is it talking about the physical creation when we talk about things like this? I mentioned to you last week that Genesis 37 verses 9 and 10, which is the first occurrence of the phrase, the sun, moon, and stars, that actual occurrence has to do with the nation of Israel, the nation of Israel. And it's used that way relative to nationalism throughout the Old Testament. But primarily it's used in regards to a reference to the nation of Israel. And it's not to be understood in some sort of a literalistic cosmology in any way, shape, or form. Now, like I said, there are some places where the heavens and the earth does refer to the physicality of the creation. Certainly the very first occurrence of it, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And then you get this litany of day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, all the way through day 6. And of course, day 7 is the Old Covenant Sabbath. God rested. And the Old Covenant Sabbath has to do with recognizing the completion of God's physical creation. But on the sixth day of God's creation, we discovered last week in Genesis 1, starting verse 24, 25, 26, that area right in there, that on that sixth day, not only was man created, but man was also given work to do. Man was given a covenant by God for him to take God's creation and rule over it. There was rulership under God's hand. And that is a part, rulership and order is got man ruling because he's made in the image of God, ruling under God's authority over his creation. That is a part of what's known as the heavens and the earth. And that's why Moses says in Genesis 2:1, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, completed, and all their hosts. Notice that the phrase host, which sometimes has to do with angels, sometimes has to do with the physical creation, notice that is in addition to the heavens and the earth. So he wants us to understand that the phrase heavens and earth in Genesis, yes, does include the physicality of God's creation. However, when it comes to man and man's heavens and earth, his order and his rulership of the planet and God's creation of the creatures in the sea, the land animals, and this sort of a thing, that has to do with the phrase the heavens and earth. And so we took that and we began to stroll through passages in Isaiah. Isaiah 51, for instance. Isaiah 65, which talks about a new heavens and a new earth. And Isaiah 50 and 51, which actually I should say 51, verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, as well as other passages in Isaiah 51, that where God talks about that the speaking forth of his word is the heavens and the earth that gets planted upon this earth. And it's a reference, heavens and earth is a reference to God speaking forth his word and his covenant amongst his people, and God refers to it as a heavens and an earth. And that's out of Isaiah 51 verses 4 and 6, as well as verse 16 in Isaiah 51. And so we took you through several of those passages last time. Then we took you through some various secondary sources, like I began to tell you, Josephus. We read from his history and how that the Jews understood that the heavens and the earth was a reference to the temple and all that went on inside of that. Gives us insight to understand that in Matthew 24, at the end, actually it's midway point through the chapter, but as Jesus is concluding his reference to the Olivet Discourse with the destruction of the temple, that he summarizes it as the heavens and the earth would pass away, but my words will not pass away. Remember that? What was Jesus talking about? He was talking about the same thing Josephus was talking about in the first century, making reference to the temple. Not the physical creation that would pass away, but that the temple would pass away. Now, why is this kind of information important in regards to understanding biblical preterism and the eschatology of the New Testament? It's important because we have to understand that Jesus was summarizing all of these things and making them happen, saying they would happen within the first century between AD 66 and 70, when the temple would in fact be destroyed. And so Jesus' second coming is directly linked up, according to Matthew 24, verse 30, verse 31, verse 32, all the way down through 35 right there. It's all talking about the passing of the heavens and the earth coinciding with his second coming. And that's the only second coming that there is. And we also took you through some other secondary sources, like Joshua Berman's book on the temple, where he refers to the fact that the Jews refer to the building up of the temple as the heavens and the earth. We took you into Abraham Cohen's book, Every Man's Talmud, to back that up as well. And then also Moses Maimonides, who wrote in the year early 1000s, and he was a Jewish scholar, and he wrote in his book Guide for the Perplexed, and I don't think I gave you that title last week, I just read out of the book, but the title of the book is called A Guide for the Perplexed. I believe you can get a copy. You might be able to get it off of Amazon, I'm not entirely sure. But he goes into the carrying on of that exact same. And these guys aren't Christians. You know, they don't have an axe to grind in trying to prove that the historical Jesus of Nazareth was the Messiah and that he told the truth in regards to his second coming, that it would happen in the first century. But rather, they're showing us that according to Jewish understanding, theologies, hermeneutics that were passed on through the generations, that these things about the heavens and the earth were, in fact, referring to the temple and the things of the temple, the things of the covenant, which is exactly, by the way, what Peter was talking about in 2 Peter, the third chapter. And so what I would like to do tonight is I would like to pick up now, finishing up, this will be part two of the heavens of the earth, give you a little bit of further information in regards to the Old Testament teaching on the phrase the heavens and the earth, and then I want to spend a little bit of time, it won't take very long actually, I want to read to you yet another older commentary, but this time it's in the Reformed camp. I want to read to you a portion out of a sermon by John Owen, who was probably, and normally I don't talk this way about other men from the past, I think we do too much, probably a little too much with that, but this man, John Owen, there probably wasn't a brain like him anywhere, hasn't been since. And if you have the opportunity to pick up John Owen's works, which are 16 volumes, you should do that and begin to go through those things. There is an index in the 16th volume number 16. So if you want to go through various subjects that he covers, you can do that. I want to take you through a portion of his sermon out of 2 Peter, the third chapter, where you can hear from a man in the Reformed camp, Orthodox Reformed man, who speaks about Peter's use of the heavens and the earth the same way I've been talking to you about this, in the same way the ancient Jewish writers talked about this. And he talks about the fact that the heavens and earth, not the cosmological literalness, was going to blow up or melt or be on fire, but it's about the temple being destroyed. It's about the covenant, the old covenant being destroyed that was represented by the temple in the first century, and that lines up with the second coming of Christ. We'll look at that. And then I want to take you into the New Testament passages that deal with Jesus' own use, by the way, of the term heavens and earth, maybe a little bit out of Hebrews, and then if we have time, a little bit more into 2 Peter, the third chapter. So what I'd like to do right now is give you a couple of more passages out of the Old Testament where it talks about the heavens and the earth relative to that phrase meaning the old covenant, God's covenant with his people, Israel. And we'll start in Psalm 50 right now. So if you have your Bibles, and you should, you can slip over to the 50th Psalm with me, Psalm 50, and verses 4 and 5. Psalm 50, verses 4 and 5. And this is a psalm of Asaph, who is writing. Talks about how then verse 2, out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God has shone forth. He speaks about God coming and not keeping silence in verse 3, how that a fire devours before him, and it is very tempestuous around him. And then he says this in verse 4 and 5 of Psalm 50, quote, he, God, summons the heavens above and the earth to judge his people. So he's calling on the heavens and the earth to judge his people. And then in verse 5, we get a definition of what the heavens and the earth are that he's talking about in verse 4. Look at verse 5. He says, gather my godly ones to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And then verse 6, and the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. So clearly we've got poetry going on right here, but he's not using the phrase the heavens and the earth in any kind of a finite, literal sense, is he? He's not talking about the heavens and the earth as God's physical creations. He's not talking about inanimate objects of the heavens and the earth, dirt, rocks, trees, God's creation of animals, or the starry heavens above, or something like that. Rather, he says, the heavens and the earth are being summoned in verse 4 as he speaks to his people. And it's for the purpose of what at the bottom of verse 7? To judge his people, the heavens and the earth, to judge his people. What could that be? What kind of a thing that he's calling the heavens and the earth would judge his peoples? It would have to be something that has been established that they could understand intellectually. And then he gets into it in verse 5. He says, gather my godly ones, that's my saints, his people, which is pointing to the bottom of verse 4. Gather my godly ones to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice, and the heavens declare his righteousness. Right? Well, clearly the passage in verse 5 where it talks about the covenant that has been made between God and his people is referring back to the top of verse 4. This is the heavens and the earth that he uses to judge his people. So the heavens and the earth are the covenant that he's speaking about in verse 5 right there, whereas in verse 6, these same heavens declare his righteousness and God himself is judge. So once again, there's no way you can understand some kind of physical finiteness in regards to the creation of inanimate objects of the heavens and the earth being something that judges, that brings understanding of judge. Instead, what we're talking about is God's covenant. It's the Mosaic covenant here that judges God's people, that calls them to accountability that's being spoken to right here. Isn't that fascinating? That's fascinating. Now I'm going to have you go back to Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, all the way back to Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter. And together we're looking at verse 26, Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, and verse 26, and we probably ought to back it up to 25. Deuteronomy 4, verse 25 and 26, Moses, of course, speaking in God's name to the people of Israel, and he says, when you, become the father of children and children's children, and have remained long in the land, because now it's the second generation that Moses' 40-year wandering has all taken place at this point. As Moses is writing this, the 40-year wandering, so all of the people of that first generation that got pulled out of and experienced the deliverance from Egyptian bondage, now it's that second generation of people that are being led into the promised land. And he says, when you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land and act corruptly and make an idol in the form of everything and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God so as to provoke him to anger, what's he going to do? 26, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but you will be utterly destroyed. And he goes on to talk about how they will be scattered among many peoples, among the nations, that there they will serve other gods. And that's something that is repeated amongst the prophets as the northern kingdom gets thrown into Assyrian bondage, and then they're prophesied that they will be thrown amongst the nations. The southern kingdom will get similar language like that, except they will be thrown not amongst the nations per se, like the northern kingdom, but into the nation relative to Babylon. And then when Babylon is taken over by the Medes and the Persians, and then by the Greeks and so on and so forth, that they will deal with that, the southern kingdom. But notice at the top of 26, that when they start falling into sin, God calls the heavens and the earth to witness against them this day. What's he talking about? Is he saying that trees and rocks and dirt are going to be able to bear witness against the people of Israel in regards to their sin? No. He's talking about the same thing we read about before in Psalm 50, verses 4 through 5, or Isaiah 51, verses 4 through 6 and 16. It's talking about the covenant, in this case, the Mosaic covenant. It's the covenant of law that is going to be borne witness against those people. And because they're breaking that law, like he will later say in Deuteronomy 28, it will be that heavens and earth that will bear witness against the people in Deuteronomy 28, and they will come under the curse of the law, and they will be thrown out of the land, and there will be pestilence and various things like that. So this is talking about that, right, too, right as well. Slip on over to the 30th chapter now of Deuteronomy, the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy, and this time verse 19. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19. And he is speaking along the same lines. He is calling the people to choose life. He says it in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30, 15, he says, I have set before you today life and prosperity, or death and adversity. I command you today to love the Lord your God, walk in his ways, keep his commandments, that you might live and multiply in the land. And then 17, but if your heart turns away, you won't obey, drawn after and to the worshiping of other gods and serve them. He says in 18, I declare to you today that you will surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. Now 19, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today, and that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, and so on, he talks about. So once again, it's similar to Deuteronomy, the 4th chapter, and verse 26, where we just read. Now he's saying it in Deuteronomy 30. He's calling heaven and earth. Well, what's he doing to witness against them? Well, once again, he's calling the heavens and the earth, the Mosaic covenant, to witness against these people, that if they're going for other gods and breaking God's law, breaking his heaven and his earth, that they will pay the price for it. Very similar to what he had spoken earlier here in Deuteronomy the 28th chapter. Finally, in Deuteronomy 32, one more of these. Deuteronomy 32 now, and verse 1. Deuteronomy 32, verses 1 through 2, actually, where he says, give ear now. This is the song of Moses. Moses is speaking. Give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Remember I told you last time that heavens and earth motif of language doesn't always have the phrase heavens and earth just like that, one right after the other, in a passage, that sometimes the phrase heaven and earth is broken up where there are other words between the words heavens and earth. Here's a case. We read about some of that last week, as a matter of fact, out of Haggai, two times in Haggai, the second chapter. Here's another example. Give ear, O heavens, and let me speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. Let my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew. And he goes on from there. The teaching is a reference back to the heavens and the earth. The teaching in verse 2, referring back to the heavens and the earth in verse 1. Clearly he's not, once again, he's not talking about inanimate objects that are supposed to, verse 1, give ear to what Moses is saying. The rocks and the trees and the dirt and that kind, they don't have any ability to give ear to Moses. What's he talking about here? He's calling on the testimony of the covenant. He's calling on the testimony of the Mosaic law and the law standards to bear witness against the people, to give ear to what he is about to say. The heavens and the earth, the law is what is supposed to be bearing witness and giving ear to what he's about to say to these people, calling them into accountability and responsibility for the way that they will live and what they will believe relative to the heavens and the earth. So these are very important passages, and they all link up together with what we talked about last week in other passages, like in Isaiah 13, like in Haggai 2 verses 6 through 7, and Haggai 2 verses 21 through 22. So these are important passages for us to remember. So having done all of that, now that's the Old Testament. That's what I want to give you out of the Old Testament, linking up with last week and now today. So now let's do this. Last week I read to you some very important passages out of secondary sources that understood this type of language. And we validated and verified that this language is not something that's just hid somewhere, but that it was normal amongst Jewish writers from the first century all the way up to the early 1000s with Moses Maimonides, and brought it all the way up into modern times with Joshua Berman, who was a Jew. I believe he's still alive, who wrote the book The Temple, and he talked about how that Moses called Bezalel, who was one of the gifted individuals who would construct the furniture of the tabernacle and the insides of the tabernacle, and that it was understood that Bezalel, he said, knew how to construct the heavens and the earth. Again, underscoring for us Josephus's first century understanding, giving to us the normal understanding of the phrase heavens and earth as being a part of the temple. So I mean, my gosh, it really amplifies the fact that when Jesus is talking about the temple being destroyed and tying that in together with his second coming, and when he says the heavens and the earth are going to pass away, as he's speaking to the four disciples on the Mount of Olives, you can almost get that, just that intense picture of Jesus possibly. And see, the Mount of Olives was just on the east side of the temple proper, and you could get a great view of the temple from the Mount of Olives. And as Jesus is talking about the destruction of that temple, you could almost see him maybe perhaps wave his arm towards the temple as he says the heavens and earth would pass away. That's temporary, but my words would not pass away. Christ's words are eternal. That really changes things in regards to your understanding of the meaning of the Olivet Discourse, doesn't it? Well, sure it does. Now, we're not the only ones that see it that way, but historically in the church there have been other sharp men whom God has raised up to understand things in that way. And I want to read you a little bit out of John Owen's ninth volume here, out of the 16th volume, about his sermon on 2 Peter, the third chapter, where he talks about the meanings of the heavens and the earth. And we'll be moving, just won't take very long, but we'll be moving starting at verse 133, to at least 135 he talks about this. He speaks about observing the fact that he doesn't want to spend a lot of time with all the difficulties of these verses. He says he doesn't want to be too long, detaining from his principal intention that the apostle makes a distribution of the world into the heavens and the earth, and says that they, quote, were destroyed with water and perished. Now he says this in the middle of page 133, volume 16, in his sermon on 2 Peter, the third chapter. John Owen, quote, "We know that neither the fabric or the substance of the one or the other was destroyed," meaning under the Noahic flood, the world that then was destroyed by water and perished. And he says, "We know that neither the fabric or the substance of one or the other was destroyed, but only men that lived on the earth." Now, you remember I told you, I read to you out of passages in the Old Testament where sometimes that phrase heavens and earth refers to the governments of men. We certainly saw that in Isaiah the 13th chapter where it talks about Babylon being destroyed and that the government and the people and the philosophies that were all a part of Babylon, their heavens and earth would be destroyed. Remember we looked at that? Well, now he's speaking about the same kind of idea right here. He goes on to say that only men who lived on the earth at that time, regarding the Noahic flood, would be destroyed, but not the earth itself. He says, and the apostle tells us, verse 5, of the heavens and earth that were then, under Noah, were destroyed by water, distinct from the heavens and the earth which were now, Peter says. So he shows a distinction between the heavens and the earth in Noah's day and the heavens and the earth which were around then in the first century during Peter's lifetime, which were to be consumed by fire. And yet, as to the visible fabric of heaven and earth, physically he means, they were the same both before the flood and in the apostles' time, and continue so to this day, John Owen says. And John Owen is preaching and living and writing mid to late 1600s, okay, in England. When yet it is certain that the heavens and the earth whereof he speaks were to be destroyed and consumed by fire, listen, in that generation, John Owen says. Listen to that again. Wherein yet it is certain that the heavens and the earth, whereof he, Peter, speaks, were to be destroyed and consumed by fire in that generation. We must then, for the clearing of our foundation, a little consider what the apostle intends by the phrase, the heavens and the earth, in two places. You've got to understand that the way they wrote back then, they were intense linguists, and so lots of verbiage took place. They took great pains to communicate, and the intellectual involvement in regards to spiritual things was incredibly high during the Reformation period. I told you that the works of John Owen are covering 16 volumes in his works. And a lot of these Reformed and Puritan guys, you know, they have massive volumes of their own works. Thomas Goodwin and Richard Sibes, so many of them. I have several of their works in my library. See, they weren't distracted by TV. They weren't distracted by apps on your phone. They weren't distracted by your Kindle Fire and downloading movies and the internet and TV shows and things like that. They were very serious about their spirituality. There was no radio. There was no phone. There was nothing distracting them. There was the Word of God that they lived and breathed and preached on and wrote on extensively, massive amounts of commentaries. They knew more about the subject of the Scriptures and what the Scriptures meant than what most preachers today, including yours truly, know. So we need to give them a wide berth and not think, well, that guy, man, he wrote back then and he kind of out of touch kind of a thing. No, I'll tell you who's out of touch. Who's out of touch is the Church of the Lord Jesus, especially in regards to their theology and their eschatology over the last 100 years. We're the ones that have been out of touch, and we're the ones who need to stand on the shoulders of the theology of dead guys like John Owen and get it back together in regards to what the Bible always meant by what it says. So let's continue a little bit further. John Owen continues in regards to this teaching of what the heavens and the earth meant in Peter, in 2 Peter the third chapter. He says, quote, "It is certain that by the flood, the world, or the fabric of heaven and earth, was not destroyed, but only the inhabitants of that world." So it wasn't the physicality that would be destroyed, but it was the men and their culture and their society, which of course was a fruit of the men of that time, which was intensely evil. You just need to read the sixth chapter of Genesis, sixth and seventh chapters of Genesis to get that. And so he goes on to say, then we must consider in what sense men living in the world are said to be the world and the heavens and the earth of it. He says, I shall only insist on one instance to this purpose. Among many, in other words, he's saying I could go to a lot of different scriptures, but I'm just going to show you one in particular to prove my point. See, and it's something that I've got to bring it down into everyday English, because these guys knew how to use English, and we don't, not like they did. He says, I'll insist on only one instance to this purpose among many that may be produced. And then he says, Isaiah, he says, Isaiah 51 verses 15 and 16, which is exactly what I've been showing you last week, and I've mentioned it to you today. He continues to say, the time when the work here mentioned of the planting of the heavens and laying the foundation of the earth was performed by God was when he, quote, divided the sea, close quote, verse 15, and gave the law, verse 16, he's talking about Isaiah 51, verses 15 and 16, and said to Zion, quote, thou art my people, close quote. That is, when he took the children of Israel out of Egypt and formed them in the wilderness into a church and state, then he planted the heavens and laid the foundation of the earth and made the new world, their world. That is, he brought forth order, government, and beauty from the confusion wherein before they were. He says, this is the planting of the heavens and the laying of the foundation of the earth in the world. And hence it is that when mention is made of the destruction of a state and government, it is in that language that seems to set forth the end of the world. And he goes on to say, and in our Savior Christ's prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24, he sets it out by expressions of the same importance. In other words, he uses the same terminology as what Dr. Owen is saying right here. He goes on to say, it is evident then that in the prophetical idiom and manner of speech by, quote, the heavens and the earth, close quote, the civil and religious state and combination of men in the world and the men of them are often understood. So were the heavens and the earth, that world which then was destroyed by the flood. And that's something, isn't that amazing? Where did he get that? Well, the man was a student of Scripture, and he had access to the way the Jews used this terminology, and he understood that when Peter, a Jew, writing to other Jews, used this terminology, he meant their old Jewish heavens and earth, the Mosaic state of things relative to the temple. And he goes on talking about that. I'm sort of picking and choosing what else I should read to you. He goes on to say, but now it is evident from this place of Isaiah, and then he talks about Isaiah chapter 65, verses 21 and 22, where in verse 17, God says, I will make a new heaven and a new earth, right? That this is a prophecy of gospel times only. He means the new covenant. And that the planting of these new heavens is nothing but the creation of gospel ordinances to endure forever, and he says the same thing is so expressed in Hebrews 12, verse 26 and 28, which I'd like to take you to, but not right now. Then he says this. He says, first, there is the foundation of the apostles' inference and exhortation, quote, seeing that I have evinced that all these things, however precious they seem, or what value soever any put upon them, shall be dissolved, that is, destroyed, and that in that dreadful and fearful manner before mentioned, in a way of judgment, wrath, and vengeance, by fire and sword, let others mock at the threats of Christ's coming. He will come, and he will not tarry. And then, so he's talking about Christ's second coming, isn't he? Dr. Rowan is, here in as he's commenting on 2 Peter, the third chapter. He will come and he will not tarry. And then, with his coming, the heavens and the earth that God himself had planted, the sun, moon, and stars of the Judaical polity and church, the whole old world of worship and worshipers that stand out in their obstinacy against the Lord Christ, shall be sensibly dissolved and destroyed. This, we know, shall be the end of these things, and that shortly. Close quote. John Owen, Puritan, first rank scholar, Dr. John Owen. The Works of John Owen, volume 9, pages 133 to 135. Highly recommended that you get that. Isn't that something? Isn't that amazing? All right, let's do this. For the time that we have left, and that's as long as I want, but it's freezing in here right now. In any case, everybody's still got, you know, all their stuff on, and my fingers are really something. In any case, let's right now, let's wind this up, but let me take you into the New Testament right now, and let's do a few New Testament passages that use this phrase, heaven and earth, and you will see that it's not speaking about the inanimate objects of the physical planet or literal cosmology, stars, literal stars in the heavens, or planets, literal planets, or rocks and trees on the earth or anything like that. But rather, it's talking about the covenant. It's talking about the old covenant, which is typified and physically typified through the temple then in the first century. And I want you to go with me to Matthew's gospel. Meet me at Matthew, the fifth chapter, please. And we're going to go to the Sermon on the Mount, fifth chapter, and we're going to look at verses 17 and 18 and maybe 19 in regards to this idea of Jesus wanting the people to understand that when he came, he did not come as Messiah to destroy the law and the prophets. He didn't come to wipe that out. Rather, he came to fulfill that. And he uses that very specific statement, the heavens and the earth, to match up and talk about the law and the prophets, and that something was going to happen to the heavens and the earth relative to him fulfilling the heavens and the earth. Let's read a little bit here. Matthew, the fifth chapter, and verse 17. Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I didn't come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly," 18 says, "I say to you," and he's speaking to the group of people that are standing there before him on the mount, as he's on the mount there, "until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished." So what we've got here in verse 17 is we have a reference to the fact that he said, "I didn't come to abolish, I didn't come to katalusai," which means to loose, to fall apart. Kata intensifies it. Sometimes it means to throw down. In this case, I did not come to intensely throw down with the result of loosing. They can't hold together. The law and the prophets. I didn't come to destroy. That's the English word that word comes from. I didn't come to loosen so it can't have any substance or sticking power together. Destroy. The law and the prophets. I didn't come to destroy in verse 17 or abolish, but instead to fulfill. I came to fulfill the law and the prophets. Pleruo is the Greek word there. Yeah, fulfill. How did Christ come to fulfill the law? How did he come to fulfill the prophets? Well, of course, passages in the law that speak about him and point towards him. For instance, the entire sacrificial system, even if you just read the book of Hebrews, is all about Christ. Only Christ could fulfill that which was just pointed to in regards to the sacrificial blood offering of animals and this kind of a thing. Christ came to fulfill that. And that's, of course, in the Mosaic standards in regards to the sacrificial system, which, of course, is what the temple was all about. The temple was about sacrifice and satisfying God's righteous requirement there. But then also the prophets. He said, I came to fulfill what was written about me in the prophets. So in the law and in the prophets. And that's a number of different things, isn't it? That's Moses, of course, speaking about the coming of Christ in Isaiah, or excuse me, in Genesis, Deuteronomy, I apologize, I'm cold. Deuteronomy 18 and verses 15 through 18, where he says, Moses prophesied that God would raise up a prophet like Moses and you would listen to him. The Father actually verified that Jesus had come to fulfill Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 18. He did that at Jesus' baptism. He did that at the Mount of Transfiguration when he said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Well, in Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 18, Moses says that God's going to raise up a prophet like me, and you better listen to him. And God says that on the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. So you miss that sometimes. But the prophet's talking about that. Psalm 22, the prophet David talked about Christ coming to die on the cross, suffering like he did in Psalm 22, and then being raised from the dead. Isaiah 53, where Jesus is talked about bearing our sickness and our sin in his body and our sickness like a heavy weight upon his shoulders, you see, on the tree. And other prophets as well, Micah talking about that, Malachi talking about that, many others. So he said, I didn't come to destroy the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill the law and the prophets. He says in 18, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away. Wait a minute. He's not changing subjects here. He's still talking about the fulfilling of the law and the prophets. He says, the law and the prophets I came to fulfill, and that the heavens and the earth would have to pass away, but until it passed away, not one letter or stroke shall pass from the law until it is accomplished. So what we've got there is bookends. We've got in verse 17 the law being referred to, the law and the prophets. And then in 8, at the end of 18, he says, on the law until all is accomplished in the law. What accomplished in the law? Until he accomplishes, until he fulfills the law. So we've got the law and the prophets in 17, then at the end of 18, we've got the law again, saying that the law is going to be, the things of the law would be accomplished, but accomplished by who? Fulfilled by who? By Jesus. Now look at the top of 18. He says, for truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke of the law would pass until all is accomplished. What is the heavens and earth referring to? It's referring to the old covenant. It's referring to exactly what he said in 17. It's the law and the prophets. It's exactly what he said at the bottom of 18. It's the law that has to be fulfilled, that has to be accomplished. Are you aware that on the cross, the Lord Jesus himself and the writers of the Gospels verified that Christ was fulfilling the law and the prophets, the old heavens and the earth, the old covenant, on the cross? Let's see it. John, the 19th chapter. John, the 19th chapter. And verse 30, John 19 and verse 30, Jesus is on the cross, a sponge was dipped into sour wine, put on a branch of hyssop and brought up to his mouth. And verse 30 says, therefore, of John 19 and verse 30, therefore when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said from the cross, it is finished. It's fulfilled. Tetelestai is the Greek word here that John uses. Tetelestai. There's a fulfilling that's going on right here. It's done. It's finished. Tetelestai. The old covenant is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Now, why do I say that? Well, look back now on Matthew 27 and verse 51. I wanted you to hear that, to tetelestai. it is finished. It also means the debt is paid, by the way. That Greek word, the debt is paid. Often when a guy would come in and pay off that last little bit on his note, on his debt, the man who received payment would write tetelestai on the bill. Paid in full, or fulfilled, was the idea. And now in Matthew 27, and let's start at verse 50. Verse 50 and 51. On the cross, Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. You know what he cried out? Tetelestai. The debt's paid. It's fulfilled. And then 51. Look at what happens as a result of the debt being paid, of the law and the prophets, the heavens and the earth being fulfilled. Look at what happens. 51. And behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to the bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. Now, the purpose of the veil in the temples, it separated the holy place from the holy of holies. And you understand that that veil that separated the holy place from the holy of holies, that veil was pierced only one time every year by the high priest on Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement. The centerpiece of all Israel and all of the work of satisfaction through animal blood sacrifices that went on, which God never desired, by the way, according to Psalm 40. God never desired that, according to Psalm 40 and repeated by him in Hebrews, the 10th chapter. But the centerpiece, the entire point of the entire temple, was what was just beyond that veil in the Holy of Holies. That's where the priest, of course, would meet with God once a year. And he would pierce that veil, and he would take the blood of the animal sacrifice and sprinkle it seven times on top of the ark. And on top of the ark was known as the mercy seat, the alisterion. That means propitiation. It was called mercy seat, but it was known as the alisterion, propitiation, substitute. Jesus was our substitute. That's why passages in Romans and Hebrews and 1 John refer to Jesus as our elasterion. He is our propitiation. He is our satisfactory substitute. See? And then on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go in and sprinkle the blood seven times on there and satisfy God's righteous requirement for the nation of Israel for that year. But because it was animal blood, it was only temporary. It had to be repeated again and again and again. Only Christ's blood is not repeated. Once did he satisfy God's righteous requirement for us on the cross. And so, when God then says, as Jesus said in Matthew 5, verses 17 and 18, I didn't come to destroy the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill, because until heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or tittle, the old covenant, not one jot or tittle of the law would pass until all of it is fulfilled. Well, in John 19, verse 30, he says, tetelestai, it's fulfilled. The debt is paid. It's finished. And then Matthew tells us in Matthew 27, 51, that physically, when Jesus said that and he gave up his spirit, God was satisfied. The propitiation was made for all those who would believe on him. That the temple, now that veil in the temple was no longer necessary. God rent it himself from top to the bottom. What's he saying? He's saying, all those who believe in me, come. Come to me. Now the debt is paid. There is no dividing veil between us. It's all over with. In other words, all of the law and all of the prophets concerning Christ was fulfilled at that moment. There didn't have to be one more animal sacrifice. Not one more feast needed to be fulfilled. Not one jot, not one little tittle of the law needed to be fulfilled in any way, shape, or form. God was satisfied because his Son provided the absolute substitute, satisfying God's righteous requirement. If you're not a preterist, guess what you just missed out on? That's right. Do you remember back in the first two installments of this, I spoke to you out of the ninth chapter of Hebrews? We're not going to go there right now. Verses 24 down through 28, where the writer there talks about how that the high priest would function in such a way that Jesus came to fulfill that position of the high priest and with his own blood would go in. The high priest would, like the writer to the Hebrews said in Hebrews 9, verse 24 through 28, the high priest would go into the holy place and then have to come out a second time and appear before the people that he had just sacrificed the animal for. He had to come back the second time, to the same people he sacrificed for. When did Jesus sacrifice himself? In the year 2000? 2013? In the first century, he came back to the same generation. This generation will not pass until all things will be fulfilled, he said in Matthew 24. And the high priest comes back the second time so that his appearance would verify that God accepted the sacrifice for yet another year. Jesus comes back to the exact same generation, like he said he would, to the temple, and not only shows in his second coming that God had received and was satisfied with his sacrifice, but then he destroys the temple, the old covenant means of animal sacrifice once and for all, because it is not only unnecessary, but it's a blasphemy for that to continue to go on in light of the fact that he had finished the work on the cross. When he cried in John 19:30, Tetelestai, it is finished. There was nothing left to do. It is finished. That's why in the book of Hebrews, Jesus, as opposed to the old covenant prophets, Jesus sits down at the right hand of the Father, because there's nothing left to do. But in the old covenant, there was no chair in the holy place, or let alone in the Holy of Holies, because the work of sacrifice was never done. But Jesus comes and he sits down. That's why Hebrews 9, 24 through 28, especially verse 28, says that Jesus will, for those who look for him, he would come back, return the second time, like the old covenant high priest would have to do. Jesus would come back the second time, not to deal with sin, but to bring salvation. He comes back to ratify and verify that salvation has been achieved. And it happened in AD 70. Why do you want to be a futurist? Why do you want to think Jesus is still coming back? What kind of effect does that have on your understanding of your salvation? That has a critical effect on it, doesn't it? Now listen to me. I always have to say this. I am not saying that if you don't believe Jesus came back in his second coming AD 70, that you're not saved. I am not saying that. I am saying, however, that that's what the Bible teaches, that the salvation program was ratified. Jesus did the finished satisfactory work of propitiation on the cross 40 years earlier. God says, I accepted that sacrifice by raising him from the dead on the third day, physically, tangibly, and absolutely. Romans 4:25 says that through the resurrection, we are justified. But Jesus had to come back the second time to fulfill the old covenant high priest picture of the priest on the Day of Atonement coming out of the Holy of Holies, out of the temple, the second time. He had to come back the second time so the people would see him. He came the first time, he goes in, he's got to come back the second time so the people see him. And Jesus taught in Matthew the 24th chapter that what would be seen of him coming back the second time, the earthly scene of that, the validation of that on the earth, would be the physical destruction of the temple. God has destroyed that temple so that none of that gets repeated. And I got dispensational futurists today that are insisting in an unbiblical fashion. And let's face it, it's a blasphemy that are saying, dispensational theology, that is saying that when Jesus comes back still in our future, that the physical temple will be rebuilt in Jerusalem and that animal sacrifices would be resumed, only this time it would be as a memorial unto the finished work of Christ. Ladies and gentlemen, what? There is no such thing anywhere in the Bible that even implies such a blasphemy. Tetelestai, it is finished. Isn't that fascinating? Don't you just love that? Oh, and by the way, I'm freezing. In Luke's gospel, Jesus says to the boys on the day of his resurrection, you got to see this. In Luke's gospel, Luke the 24th chapter and verse 44, watch this, because I'm winding this up now. I'm winding this up. In Luke's gospel, the 24th chapter, verse 44, Jesus has just appeared on Resurrection Sunday, on the first of the Sabbaths, the Miantôn Sabbaton, because that's what all the gospel accounts say in the Greek text. Of all the gospel accounts, when it talks about the day he was raised, that day is referred to as the Miantôn Sabbaton, the first of the Sabbaths. Not an old covenant Sabbath, new covenant Sabbath, where we rest in the finished work of Christ. Okay, and he comes to them on that day, verse 44, and he says to them, these are my words, listen to this, these are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things which are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. What's he referring to? Well, he's referring to Matthew 5, 17, and 18. That's what he's referring to. He says, don't think that I came to destroy the law and the prophets. I didn't come to destroy. I came to fulfill, because until heaven and earth pass away, the old covenant passes away. Not one jot or tittle of the law will pass till it's all fulfilled. Only Christ could fulfill it. And now, in Luke 24, 44, that's precisely what he's referring to. When he says to them, these are my words which I spoke to you, he's referring back to Matthew 5, 17 and 18. While I was with you, that the law, all that was written about me in the law, the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. And then he had to open their minds to understand the scriptures. Well, I would hope to shout. And he said to them, thus it is written that Christ would suffer and rise again from the dead on the third day. All that stuff talk about in the law and the prophets and the Psalms. You see, the phrase law and the prophets in Jewish parlance did include the Psalms. Sometimes it would just be the law. That would also sometimes include the prophets and the Psalms. That's the way they spoke back then. So here you've got an aspect where he just brings all three together. The law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. So did he do it? Did he do it? Because part of that fulfillment has to be the rest of what he talked about, and that is the closing down of the salvation program. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, Jesus is like, oh my gosh, are you kidding me? I think that's enough for tonight, because the next thing I was going to do is take you into 2 Peter, the third chapter. That's going to take me a whole lot longer. But listen, ladies and gentlemen, this is this type of information. When we talk about our soteriology, which is the subject of the study of salvation, and we bring the subject of the second coming, the parousia of Christ, into it, and hopefully you've been listening to and watching all of these episodes where we have taken you through the gospel accounts, the accounts of the apostles, the writing of the apostles in the epistles, where there is a consistent voice about he's coming back in his one and only second coming during that lifetime of some of those who were standing here, Matthew 16, verses 27 and 28, and so many other passages that we've talked about. And then we bring in things like this, where the phrase the heavens and earth has got to be respected and understood for what it originally meant. It's talking about, as we have been using it here through these passages, as the New Testament and the Old Testament uses it, it's talking about the covenant of God, the Mosaic covenant, the Old Covenant. And then Jesus uses that exact same phraseology to talk about the law and the prophets. And then Jesus says in Luke 24, 44, I did it. I have fulfilled all that was written about me in the law and the prophets and the Psalms. And we understand that the heavens and the earth had to be shut down. The old heavens and the earth had to be shut down. And that's what Peter's talking about in 2 Peter, the third chapter. He says, man, I'll tell you what, Jesus comes back just like we're expecting him to. Hebrews 9:28. For those who look for him the second time, he will appear not to deal with sin, but to bring salvation. And he's got to come back like the high priest did to the temple, to the same people in the first century whom he sacrificed himself for. And so consequently, when he does that, Peter talks about that. For Peter, it was in their future because he was writing pre-AD 70. And he's saying that old heavens and the earth is going to melt like fire. It's going to burn up. And he's talking about the temple and the old covenant that it represented. So that when we see Jesus saying tetelestai, it is finished. It's finished. And that also has to include that first century second coming. In Matthew 24, Jesus said this generation, the generation he was living in consistently, this will not pass. He says, till all these things be fulfilled. And the all these things refers back to verse 30 and 31 that preceded that statement, which was a reference to his second coming. Heaven and earth would pass away as he took a sweep with his arm, possibly, from the Mount of Olives. Heaven and earth would pass away as he pointed towards the temple, but my words would not pass away. Why would you not want to be a preterist? Well, episode 8 is coming up next. I'm Dr. Kelly Nelson Burks. Love to hear from you. You can go to our website, drkellynelsonburks.com, drkellynelsonburks.com. No period after the DR for doctor, just straight ahead. We have all kinds of things for you to look at, media, strong media. You can download lots of different messages that I preach here at Messiah Reformed Church over the years. Also, be aware of getting yourself hooked up onto the subscription channel here on YouTube, where you can see and listen to not only my teachings, if you like, or if you're sick of me, you can certainly listen to other good men here in the congregation, the elders preach, Elder Brian Dogan, Elder Tony Floyd, Elder Keith Bernhagen, they're all on there as well. And you can go to Brian D, that's B-R-Y-A-N, D, you can subscribe right there. And we have all these things, Brian's got it all set up in categories, and it's easy to view and all that. Also, make sure you tweet me. I just tweet. Dr. Kelly Burks. And I'll get that in my inbox, and I'll respond to some of that. Some of you have been doing that. You know, you've been very kind to go ahead and do that. So until next time, give these things serious thought, please. Give these things serious thought. And we'll be here. Hopefully it'll be warmer tomorrow night at Bible study for our study in John. God bless you. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.